rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on CRN Digital, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, podcast at Apple's iTunes, and on RadioPower.org. Welcome to our program. And some of the folks in our chat room talking about Hugo Chavez. Is George Bush going to let him get away with his plan to give discounted fuel, heating oil, to Americans through the Citgo system that he has? He has said he's going to make available 80,000 barrels of oil a day. Well, different numbers are being reported. Apparently, this came out of his meetings with Jesse Jackson yesterday, providing cheap oil for Americans to heat their homes with, for poor, low-income Americans. Definitely something the Bush administration would not like. And one of the folks in our chat room, Glenn in our chat room, talks about how he saw last night a special on TV, the Discover Times, a program apparently on the Discovery Channel, on Venezuela's election monitored by Jimmy Carter. He says it was a good show. Condoleezza criticized Chavez. Apparently we only like our men to win Democratic elections, not those who help the poor and give them housing and health care. Well said, Glenn. Thank you very much. If you want to drop into our chat room, by the way, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It'll get you in there. And if you'd like to call the program, our toll-free number across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. BuzzFlash.com is doing a special petition. This is worth taking a moment of your time and going to BuzzFlash.com and checking this thing out. It's signed the petition of redress. Either the Bush kids put their lives on the line for Georgia's noble war or the troops come home. Here's what the petition says. It's two sentences, very straightforward. I demand that George W. Bush's daughters and his eligible nieces and nephews serve in Iraq to prove their support of Bush's noble war for a noble cause. If the Bush family does not believe in sacrificing for the war and is not willing to put their lives on the line, then Bush must bring the troops of the middle class and poor Americans home now. Now, if you look at the Bush brothers, George W., Jeb, Neil, and Marvin, the only one of them who served in the military at all was George W., and he was AWOL for a half a year, or more, almost a year, and then wrote a letter to the National Guard saying, may I please get out 6 months early so that I can go to Harvard? And they said, yes, sure, you can get out. Of their children, Jenna and Barbara Bush, the children of George W. Bush, Jeb Bush's children, George P. Bush, Noel Bush, and John Ellis Bush, Jr., these are all service eligible. They're all old enough to serve right now. These are military service eligible children, Neil Bush's children, Lauren Bush and Pierce Bush, Marvin Bush's child, Marshall Bush, and Dorothy Bush's children, Samuel LeBlond and Ellie LeBlond. Of all of those children, not one single one has chosen to serve this country in the military uniform. Not one. Oh, but it's a noble cause. So check out the petition. Go to BuzzFlash.com and sign it. I did this morning. I feel better. Bev Harris is with us with blackboxvoting.org, blackboxvoting.org. Bev, the world's expert on voting machines and voting technology. Hey, Bev.
Hey.
So great to have you on the program today. Yeah, Black Box Voting is engaged in a new educational campaign. You've got a program going on. Tell us about it.
Well, we've got an online think tank. You know, we see the the right wing, you know, financing hundreds of these think tanks, and we wanted to do something that didn't cost an arm and a leg so that the regular, ordinary citizens of America could participate. And the topic is, of course, election reform. And it's been very well received. It's been going on since Saturday, and it will continue through Labor Day. And it addresses a lot of different kinds of issues. It's called Think Outside the Black Box.
That's great.
And,
outside the black box.
And you know, it's amazing how well it's working because people are coming. I'm working on a distillation of just the ideas that have come forth in the last 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful, practical, inexpensive, rapid deployment ideas to make a real difference in elections.
Now, how does this thing work? If I have a computer, I'm on the internet, I go over to blackboxvoting.org, and then what?
right at the top it says enter the think tank, and you click that link. And if you want to post anything, you simply sign in over to the left. It gives you instructions to do that. You don't have to go through any rigmarole.
I don't have to give you a credit card number or any kind of nonsense.
No, and you don't even have to wait for an email. You're instantly in.
Okay.
The only requirement we have is that people, we call it real people, real solutions, and we do real names, not, you know, fake names.
Right.
Or, you know, pretend names or cartoon names or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So, handles is their name.
Yes. Yeah. And the reason for that is we feel that it shows leadership, and what we need is regular people, ordinary citizens like me, who go out and just get involved.
Mm-hmm.
And do so without, when they do that, and you'll see a lot of examples of these folks on our site, a lot of wonderful things happen, and it inspires other ordinary citizens to take action themselves.
So if I go over there and I sign on, and which I will be doing, by the way, because I guess I'm going to be one of your guests
tomorrow
afternoon.
We're so fortunate.
Yeah, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. Pacific Time. But if I was just going to go in this afternoon and check it out, I just go in, I sign in. Mm-hmm. And is it like a blog where there's consecutive posts, or is it like a live chat room where there's an ongoing discussion?
It's a live blog, essentially, where you can come in and at the bottom of all of the things that people are saying, there's a box where you can type in your own comments. They appear, you know, in real time as soon as you push post. And the quality of discourse is what we're so pleased at, because it's really very articulate, very intelligent commentary. And a lot of real experts who have made themselves available, so that we're getting a very, it gives you the chance to ask questions, really get some sort of hand-holding for things that you may be going through. We always have people say, well, what can I do? Well, you know, first of all, do something. Start, because when you do any action, you learn more about the next. But it gives you a chance to say, hey, you know, I've got a meeting with so-and-so. Can someone help me know what to say?
Right.
And some real experts weigh in to give you kind of one-on-one feedback.
What is the state in the United States right now of affairs with regard to our vote? Is our vote becoming more or less secure? Do you think that there was actual fraud in the 2000, 2002, and 2004 elections that involved manipulation of voting machines? And if so, is the potential for that increasing or decreasing?
There probably was actual fraud. In fact, there's very strong evidence that there was actual fraud. And the potential is increasing. A little historical perspective, there was some really terrible fraud back in, you know, about a century and a half ago. And it kind of goes, it's a pendulum, it kind of ebbs and flows. But we're right now in a very high fraud period. And these new election procedures and voting machines and the new computerized voter registration systems are opening up a whole lot of new attack points that simply haven't been addressed. So many times when we add technology into the mix, you know, we discover a couple years later that we blew it because we didn't add in the appropriate checks and balances, and that's very true of what's going on with voting.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, my concern, frankly, I have to say, is to take it beyond checks and balances and to simply ask the question, why in the first place do we have private corporations handling something as sacred, such a sacred part of the commons, as our vote? When did this start?
Well, it started back in the late 1800s, but it's ramped up and on steroids right now.
Late 1800s, corporations got in the voting business?
Yes, they got in. That's when lever machines were invented. And in some of the areas in the Northeast, in the 1890s, actually, some corporations got in and put in lever machines, like Shooptronic and so forth. And then in the 60s, we started getting these punch cards. And then in the early 80s, we got optical scans. And then we got into touch screens in the 90s. But what we see in the last couple of decades is a systematic changing of the laws that used to protect us in elections. I mean, they've just been tinkering and tinkering and tinkering. And we all know what happens when you do that is you get unexpected results. You know, they don't do a pilot project. They just run out there and say, let's change the laws for the state, and now we're going to do all mail-in, or now we're going to try no ballots, you know. And it's really opened up a playground for those who wish to manipulate elections, because what we're finding is typically elections officials themselves are quite naive about the attack points in computerized systems.
Why would they be naive about this? I mean, their job is to run our elections.
Well, they are reassured by the vendor that it's all safe, and then they're reassured by a handful of folks on a committee that these things have been certified. And what we've since found is that the machines, the certification process broke down, if it ever even worked. It certainly broke down because these machines are very easy to manipulate and actually violate their own standards in many cases. But it's become a situation where the elections officials have become dependent on the vendors to even run an election, especially in some of the smaller counties where they don't even have their own computer staff. So, you know, you get kind of a people person who's out there, and they're good at being an election official because they like people, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of typical scenario. And then they're handed this computerized system, and they have no idea how to run the computerized system. So the vendor says, not to worry, we'll send in our guy, and he'll help you run everything on election day. And that way you don't have any overhead while you're not having elections. Well, what that means is exactly what you said. You just turned over your entire election to a privatized for-profit corporation, and you have no idea what they're doing.
How do we stop this?
It's going to have to be attacked on a number of fronts, and actually the root cause, all the way at the bottom of the tree, is the corporate personhood issue, where corporations have the right, supposedly, to the First Amendment, and they can buy their way into all kinds of things by, you know, financially supporting campaigns and politicians.
Yeah. Although it's unlikely that we're going to roll back corporate personhood next week.
Exactly. That's the root. But
we could reclaim our commons, couldn't we? I mean, everybody understands, hey, we don't want to privatize our police department. We don't want to privatize our fire departments. We don't want to privatize our schools. Well, some of the cons among us want to privatize our schools. But by and large, it's a consensus. Right. We don't want private corporations dealing with our streets.
It's moving that direction, you see, and so it is important to know the root causes. I mean, I know that Kiewit was privatized a freeway in the Riverside area of California, so,
yeah.
You know, they consider it inventory that they can go by. But anyway, there are a number of different fronts that this needs to be attacked on, and what we're focusing on this think tank is things that are cheap, quick to deploy, that just a few people can do on their own without passing any new laws. And it is amazing how really wonderful ideas are coming forth that are quite clever to actually get some leverage. We're really wanting things that we don't have to ever rely on a corporation or a handful of experts, even if they're government experts. We want to put the people back in control of their own elections, and that means we need to be able to see our vote. We need to be able to see the counting of our vote.
Yeah, well said. We're talking with Bev Harris at blackboxvoting.org. Bev, can you stick around for just a few minutes? Bev?
Yes.
Yeah, you can stick around for a minute or so?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. We're speaking with Bev Harris at blackboxvoting.org. We'll be back with your calls and further questions in just a moment. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Bev Harris is with us with blackboxvoting.org. And Bev, a couple of quick calls for you here. First, Dave in Eureka. You're live with Bev Harris. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Bev, it is my sincere hope that you and Cindy Sheehan will get to share the next Nobel Prize for your efforts. And I think, to me, one thing says it all, and that is that the GOP leadership in the Congress, Senate and House, will not allow any bill to come to a vote that would make these machines verifiable and honest. And that tells me everything in itself.
So the question is, Bev, what's your take on Rush Holt's bill?
Can it possibly get to the
floor? Well, actually, my take on Rush Holt's bill is it's not actually the solution anyway. It helps, but it's so much effort put into something that actually is not going to change anything. Except theoretically and potentially. And the reason I say that is because the laws are such that we cannot make use of those paper trails. And until we can change that part of it, until we can address what we do with the paper in a meaningful way, you know, it really needs to go in tandem, because people then feel like, well, we got a paper trail, but it really is only the potential for a paper trail, because in so many states you just can't look at it. In my state, 3 million voters, they have to be within 200 votes of each other out of 3 million in order to look at that paper ballot.
Otherwise, you are forbidden by law from looking at the ballot?
Forbidden.
Wow.
Now, you can look at three precincts, but in a county like King County, which has hundreds and hundreds of precincts,
right.
You know, you're talking about a system that just is not verifiable.
So if you're going to steal an election, you just do like, by coincidence, what happened in Ohio very recently, where with Paul Hackett's election that he lost at the very last minute. It was 50-50, 50-50, 50-50, mm-hmm. and then at the very last minute, this one county that had locked down during the Bushy election,
mm-hmm.
All of a sudden... pulls out of the hat just enough votes to toss it over the 3% margin that would trigger a recall, so that now nobody can even look at those ballots.
Exactly. That's the big glitch with all this stuff. There's two things, and one is, you know, obviously if you're going to manipulate it, you're going to manipulate it past that trigger point so that it doesn't trigger a recount. And in the states, which is only a few states have a mandatory spot check recount, but oh my goodness, do they tamper with that. And Ohio was a wonderful example of that. 3% were supposed to be spot checked, and they played so many games. They were not randomly chosen. They secretly counted them behind the scenes before they brought them out to make sure they would match. And, you know, so
incredible, incredible.
You know, we've got to do with that.
So
with
it's not enough. We got Ed in Shawnee, Kansas, on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Good.
Bev, I just, this is something I've actually written this to Tom once before, but I just had a thought on these touchscreen machines, that if we did have printers on them and actually created printed ballots that were completed ballots, and they were submitted to an optical scanner to be counted, and then a comparison between the count tallies on the optical scanner and the voting machines from which they came were compared, and for that to trigger the recount, it'd be very hard to...
It would be like double-entry bookkeeping. You'd be
like
generating a checksum.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that, Bev?
It would be helpful, possibly quite helpful, but then you get into a lot of other issues, so the devil will be in the details. For example, if the same company makes both systems, then you're pretty much out of luck. We were able to successfully manipulate an optical scan, really leaving no trace. Very quickly, and we demonstrated that on the Diebold optical scan system in Florida. So what you would need to do with that is be able to find a way to make it truly an independent system. And the other thing I don't like about that is it still keeps people out of the equation. We want to have people, you still can't see what's going on inside that machine. You can only see what people are feeding through it, and a representation in the form of a report that comes out later. I just really prefer something that is a little bit more inclusive of the American public if we can get it.
Yeah, okay. Bev Harris with blackboxvoting.org. Check out the website. You've got it's not a teach-in. What are you calling this thing, Bev?
It's an online think tank.
An online think tank. Thank you very much. The online think tank is going on now at blackboxvoting.org, and will be going on right through Labor Day, isn't it?
Yes.
Great. Check it out. Bev, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Keep up the great work. I agree with Dave. You deserve a Nobel Prize. It is 29 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. Warning, prolonged listening may cause independent thinking and increased voter turnout.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Evolutionary talk radio. Intelligently designed. Our program brought to you today by MotorSilk. 1-866 less fuel. Stuff I use in my car to improve gas mileage and reduce emissions. EvergreenAmerica.com, their website. 1-866 less fuel. Thanks for being with us. It is... 33 minutes. Coming up on 34 minutes past the hour. Ryan in Elgin is on the line. Hey, Ryan.
How Tom. Well, I just finished a six-week trip through South America, and thanks to White Rose Society, I never missed a day of your show.
Oh, that's great.
So that's big thanks to Ben Birch.
Indeed.
Well, I actually arrived in Venezuela on the day that Pat Robertson issued his fatwa, and...
Oh, that must have been interesting. Do you speak Spanish?
Yes. Sorry?
Do you speak Spanish?
I get by.
Okay, so you had some sense of how the country was actually responding.
I did, and it was big news over there. And two things really struck me about Venezuela is that society is very divided, just like ours, and also it's extremely politically active. Everybody is very politically aware and especially eager to share their opinion with me as an American. And so, as you know, Chavez does have a huge groundswell of support among the poor who regard him as the next Che Guevara. And also the elite...
Or as the next George Washington. I mean, it's not the poor who view him as some ideologue. They view him simply as the leader of the country and as the person who's going to make life possible, you know, a better life possible for them.
Oh, yeah. A woman who was selling shoes in the marketplace was telling me about how her daughter had won some scholarship to go to Cuba based on a program that Chavez started up, and that just wouldn't have been possible before. And there were plenty of the conservatives, mostly among the elite, who told me that they wished that somebody would assassinate Chavez. And if you talk to them, there was really a strain of that traditional notion that the right of the wealthy to keep their wealth is more important than the right of the poor to survive. But also, even among these elite, they would still qualify their opinions by saying, now don't get me wrong, I'm not a supporter of Bush, and I think that the CIA should mind their own business. So really the whole country is against American interventionism in the region. And I thought that was really interesting that they didn't support Bush.
Yeah, and nothing new. I mean, I think every country, that's the basic instinct. I mean, if Canada was rumbling about, rolling troops into the United States to displace George W. Bush because he violated international law by invading Iraq, I think average Americans left, right, and center would all be saying, hey, wait a minute, we'll be there at the border. You know, we're going to stop the Canadians.
Oh, exactly.
I mean, even though I disagree with Bush, I don't want Canada running my country. I don't. I want us running our country. Bad joke, I'm sorry. I think that nationalistic, the positive side of nationalism, there certainly can be an evil or dark side of nationalism, but that positive side of nationalism is part of the human instinct, part of the tribe, clan, family instinct that's part of our DNA of, you know, we're in this together and therefore we've got to look out for each other and make things right. is pretty pervasive and probably a pretty good thing. So, very interesting. Thank you for that feedback, Ryan.
Oh, thank you.
It sounds fascinating. It reminds me of, and thanks for the call, it reminds me of the trip I made to Argentina in 2002. I was in, was it San Paulo? No, that's Brazil. In any case, I was in the capital city of Argentina, and I remember a person at the airport who gave me this long rant about how, don't worry, George Bush is not going to invade Iraq until after the 2002 elections. He's going to use the threat of invading Iraq as a way to get everybody all whipped up and to make the Democrats look bad or make them look like wusses. And then after the elections, he will invade Iraq, only he'll do so in a way that he'll still have an active war going on in 2004 because he knows that a war president is going to get reelected. And then he'll get actually elected for the first time because he was appointed the first time in 2000. And this guy, you know, he was just like, this was like the Argentinians looking at our politics and seeing Bush as this corrupt manipulator of us, for political capital. Extraordinary. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number, toll free across the United States. Steve in Grand Rapids on the line in Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I don't know if you heard about this, but it's been discussed in the chat room a bit that martial law has been declared in New Orleans.
Okay.
And
it doesn't surprise me, frankly.
And my question is, what are the implications of this for the rest of the country? And do we have anything to worry about yet?
I don't think so.
But still, what are the the implications be for New Orleans itself?
Well, for New Orleans, I mean, you've got a city that has no electricity, and you've got a fairly substantial population that is living on the edge economically, and you know, it's a really the need to declare martial law to prevent looting, which is, I'm sure, the reason that they're doing it, is more an indictment of an economic and political system that creates massive poverty and tolerates it, and in fact celebrates it in some quarters, than it is anything else. I agree with you. There is some legitimate concern about martial law anywhere, anytime, under any circumstances. The government can be a force for good or a force for evil. Steve, I'm not concerned about it.
Okay.
You know, just speaking for myself.
Yeah,
we'll see. You know, we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, because I'm just concerned that from what I've seen of the Bush administration, if martial law is declared, it's going to be abused.
Well, yeah. See, this first of all, it's not the Bush administration that's declared martial law in New Orleans. It would have to be the local authorities that have done it. Is that not the case? It would either have to be the state of Louisiana or the city of New Orleans or the county that it's in. I would be real surprised if the federal officials might be brought in, but if that area had been federalized, well, I just don't know. Steve, let me do a little research on this during the break.
Okay.
Check it out and find out, and we'll get back on this. And I'll start reading the chat room here. I'm sure these folks are very on this right now. Blue, yes. Oh yeah? Okay. In any case, a well-respected man about town. It's, here we go. Where did it go to? Nope, it's not. Anyhow, I had a sound clip for you on this, but day in the life of Joe Republican. Now, this has been floating around for a while, but it really is worth revisiting. Joe gets up at 6 o'clock in the morning to prepare his morning coffee. He fills his pot full of good, clean drinking water because some liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. He takes his daily medication with his first swallow of coffee. His medications are safe because some liberal fought to ensure their safety and work as advertised. All but $10 of his drugs are paid for by his employers, his medication, because of their medical plan, because some liberal union workers fought for employers to have paid medical insurance, and now Joe gets it too because his employer needs to offer competitive benefits to hire the best people. Joe prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs this day. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. Joe takes his morning shower, reaching for his shampoo. The bottle is properly labeled with every ingredient because some liberal fought for his right to know what he's putting on his body. Joe dresses, walks outside, takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some tree-hugging liberal fought for laws to stop industries from polluting our air. Joe drives to work in one of the safest cars in the world because some liberal fought to raise safety standards and emission controls. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with good pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays and vacation because some liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because Joe's employer doesn't want his employees to call in the union. If Joe is hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get a worker compensation or unemployment check because some liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of his temporary misfortune. It's noontime. Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC up to $100,000 because some liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from greedy, unscrupulous bankers like the ones who ruined the banking system during the Great Depression, or before the Great Depression, causing. Joe needs to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime and owned his own home. Joe is home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at his farm home in the country. He arrives at his boyhood home. He was the third generation to live in the house financed by the Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans, so liberals brought the Farmers Home Administration into being. In fact, his father's house, didn't even have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose in where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. Without the REA, those rural Republicans would still be sitting in the dark. Joe is happy to see his dad, who's now retired. His dad lives on Social Security and his union pension because some liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. After his visit with dad, he gets back in the car for the ride home. Turns on a radio talk show. The host keeps saying liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't tell Joe that his beloved Republicans have fought against every single protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe agrees with the right-wing talk show host. He says, "Nah, we don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have." Yeah. And, you know, if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. I mean, it is really and truly quite extraordinary. You know, the demagoguery around this, these well-respected men promote, you know, it's just quite extraordinary. Oh, my goodness. Fox News, when Fox News fans attack. Did you see this on August 7th? John Loftus, this was a couple of weeks ago. It's still going on. John Loftus on Fox News comes out and names a family, and names an address. Says it's the address of a terrorist, somebody who was tied into the July 7th bombings in London. It wasn't. Well, it's Fox News. I mean, you know, come on, what do you expect? It was actually the home of Randy and Ronell Vorick, an innocent California couple. And the Fox News viewers who went out and vandalized their house, when they vandalized it, they misspelled the word terrorist when they spray-painted it on their window. They spelled it T-E-R-R-I-S-T. Terrorist. And so, you know, CNN reported it straight up, but when CBS reported on it, they redid the picture. They took a picture of a house, and they painted the word terrorist, and they spelled it right. And then they showed a hand with a video camera videoing the word terrorist spelled right. So CBS cleaned up the misspelling of the Fox News viewers. It kind of gets stranger and stranger. By the way, just a Senate alert. What's going on in the United States Senate? A week from today, I believe it is. Yeah, Tuesday, a week from today, the Senate will come back into session. And you can bet that that day or soon thereafter, there will be a vote on the Paris Hilton tax cut. The Paris Hilton tax break. As the Associated Press reported, the nation's poverty rate rose to 12.7% of the population last year, the fourth consecutive annual increase. 4 years in a row, poverty in the United States exploding. Overall, there are 37 million people living in poverty as of 2004. That's 1.1 million more people than just a year earlier. The last time that poverty declined in the United States was in the year 2000, the last year of the Clinton administration. When we only had 31.1 million people in poverty, now we have 37 million people living in poverty. So the Republicans' response to this, they got it all figured out. They know just what to do. Eliminate the estate tax. That's going to solve the problem. It's just absolutely going to solve the problem. It's going to take care of it altogether. It's just eliminate the estate tax and everything will be fine. You don't get it? Well, it's. I'm sorry, neither do I. Neither does anybody else. That's the thing about these Republicans. It's just, you know, well, you know, we'll just do it, and, you know, whether it makes sense to you or not, we're going to do it. So my suggestion, contact your elected member of Congress, particularly your senators. Call 1-877-SOB-USOB, toll-free, 1-877-SOB-USOB, and say, hey, listen, I really don't think that right now in America, as we are being driven into debt by the Bush administration, as our trade deficit is exploding, as every child born into this country right now is born with $145,000 debt, run up almost entirely by Ronald Reagan and George Bush Jr., I don't think now is the time to cut taxes on Paris Hilton. It just doesn't seem like a good plan. So please do not vote to eliminate the estate tax. We'd like to keep the estate tax in place. I realize the Walton family has given you guys a lot of money, and so are a lot of other very wealthy families. But, you know, hey, it is, this country was, the founders of this country did not fight and die to create a permanent aristocracy, a permanent ruling class, a plutocracy, an oligarchy, a country where we're ruled over by a small number of very, very wealthy families. That's not how this country, those are not the founding principles of this country. No problem with people making a lot of money, and no problem with them passing so much of it down to their children that none of their children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren will ever have to work again. We can all get on board with that. But so much money that they can basically take on the government, that they can take on a state, that they can change the nature of elections, no. When wealth becomes so concentrated that it threatens democracy, then you say, enough, enough. You can be greedy, but there's a limit to it. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. More than 50. This is what an incredible confluence of ancient and modern cultures. Not so much ancient, I guess kind of mid-range ancient. More than 50,000 bare-breasted virgins, this from USA Today today, vied to become the King of Swaziland's 13th wife on Monday in a ceremony known as the Reed Dance. King Matswe III, sub-Saharan Africa's last absolute monarch, wore a leopard-skin loincloth as he watched the girls dressed in little more than beaded miniskirts dance around the royal stadium. They sang tributes to the king, 37, and the queen mother, known as the Great She-Elephant. A hopeful 16-year-old hopeful Zodwa Mamba said, "I want to live a nice life, have money, be rich, have a BMW, and a cell phone." Go figure. Go figure. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Jay in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jay, what's up?
Sure, sounds good to be a king, huh?
Maybe not. I don't know. I don't think I'd want 13 wives. I got to tell you, I'm very happy with one.
But my question is this: the term "acting," as in John Goodman playing the acting president on West Wing, would it have ever been inaccurate, even before impeachment started, to refer to Clinton as the acting president?
No. There was no time when he wasn't legally the president. But was acting as president? No.
That's my point. It seems to me that if he's legally the president, then he is also technically acting as president.
Yeah, but when you say somebody is the acting president, for example, that would be like if Bill Clinton goes into surgery and he becomes unconscious, then Al Gore is the acting president.
Okay, yeah, I'm writing a disparaging story about Bush, so I wanted to refer to him as acting President Bush.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm not sure that that's the way to do it, but I think you got a good thread there. I encourage you to follow it. Thanks a lot, Jay. Good to hear from you. Will in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Will, what's up?
It's always a pleasure, and thank you for talking to me.
Sure. We got about 30 seconds here, Will.
I'll call back.
Okay. All righty. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. The King of Swaziland. See, this is the contamination of cultures. I want to live a nice life, have money, be rich, have a BMW, and a cell phone. Zodwa Mamba, 16 years old. What have we done to the cultures of the world? That this is their aspiration. Even Americans are starting to figure out that stuff isn't what makes you happy. It's the quality of your relationships, the quality of your life. It's not what you have. I mean, beyond survival needs, of course. It's remarkable that both the toxicity and and how highly contagious consumer culture can be. It's really and truly remarkable. And then you see things like, you know, anorexia and whatnot. Anyway.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 6.5 minutes, coming up on 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program, broadcast live on radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, CRN Digital. Welcome back. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. Outside the United States, 503-248-0620. Xavier in Santa Cruz, California, on the line, listening on KRXA. Hey, Xavier, what's up? Oh, let me turn the volume on for you here first. Probably a good plan. Let's try again, Xavier.
Okay, you there?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. All right, yeah. I just wanted to... yesterday you had a caller call in and talking about... is the gap between the rich and poor gets worse, there may be a tax on the super rich. And that made me a little bit nervous hearing that, but I'm glad that you let that go through. I don't think that we're advocating that. We're just concerned about it.
No, we're definitely not advocating that.
Yeah.
But the reality is, though, in many of the countries of the world where conservative economic policies rule, for example, Colombia or Mexico, where you have plutocracies, essentially. You've got a small number of very wealthy, extremely, mind-bogglingly
right.
wealthy, and therefore very politically powerful families who have ruled for generation after generation after generation. What happens is that the massive widespread poverty is fueling a whole new industry, and that's kidnapping the few people left in the middle class. And occasionally they even get one of the super rich, but very rarely. They are so well insulated.
The point that,
kidnapping people in the middle class and holding them for ransom. And it's become a major business in Iraq right now, and it's a major business in Mexico and in Colombia. I can speak from personal experience, having seen it in those countries, and throughout much of the rest of the third world.
The point I wanted to make, though, Tom, was I often think about in physics there's a law of thermodynamics and. I see that sort of relates to economic wealth. If you think of heat as like wealth and the police and military as like insulation, the delta between the rich and poor, the disparity, the greater that gets, the more pressure there is for violence.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm X, I think it was, said that, or maybe him or Martin Luther King said, if you make peaceful revolution impossible, violent revolution is likely. And the point I wanted to make is like Hugo Chavez with his recommending that trying to get cheap oil to our poor people, and Castro maybe providing medical care. I think if that were to happen, that's a way to allow a peaceful revolution to happen. It'd be like the threat of a good example.
Yeah, the Bushies aren't going to allow it to happen, though.
We need to keep talking about it.
Yeah, for sure. Good plan. Xavier, thanks a lot for the
call.
Yeah, and this is, what Chavez is doing is he's saving capitalism from itself. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did in the United States. Capitalism nearly destroyed, unrestrained capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, nearly destroyed the United States. Capitalism works fine within boundaries. And those boundaries are the appropriate control, the appropriate regulation of the marketplace by we the people, so that the marketplace works to the benefit of those playing the game of the marketplace and benefits society, rather than works to the benefit of those playing the game of the marketplace and harms society. And just a very straightforward process. Speaking of the potential of the harm to society, Diane Wilson is with us. Diane is our Bioneer for today. Bioneers is a nonprofit organization founded in 1990 that promotes practical environmental solutions and innovative social strategies for restoring the earth and communities. Bioneers.org is their website. There will be a conference there this October. I'll be speaking at it, and you will too, Diane, I believe.
I sure am.
Great. And Diane, you have written a marvelous book titled An Unreasonable Woman, the subtitle A True Story of Shrimpers, Politicos, Polluters, and the Fight for Sea Drift, Texas. Tell us what provoked the battle that you engaged.
Well, I guess what provoked it for me is that, I'm what you call a person who has been raised my entire life in one place, you know, fourth generation. So I have a deep sense of the land and of the bay. I've been on the bay since I've been 8 years old. And so
this is the bay. This is Seadrift, Texas. Where is that in Texas?
It's the mid-Texas Gulf Coast,
okay.
You know, where Galveston's a little up above us, and we got Corpus right down below us.
Okay.
And I have a deep sense of, matter of fact, the bay was real to me. When I was little, I could see her. I could literally see her. You know, you talk about being young and being open to stuff. Well, I could see the bay, and she was a woman, and she was like a grandmother. So it was personal to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started hearing about, you know, when I found out we were like number one in the nation for toxic disposal to the land and ranking all over the place, it was personal. It was like they were doing it to my mother or my children. And what it was, you know, I'm not a real good, I wouldn't be high on your list of people that would make good activists or good speakers, but it was my passion.
Now you also
passion.
You also made your living out of the bay.
Oh yeah, I'm a shrimper, fourth generation, and matter of fact, shrimping was so bad I was it tied up my shrimp boat and I was running a fish house.
Yeah, so then you discovered that the fish that were coming out of this bay were among the most toxic in the country because the pollution in the bay was among the worst in the country, presumably because the corporations in the area were, what, lying to people about the pollution that they were, or was it George W. Was letting them do it?
Well, the thing it was is up until, like, 1989, people had no idea what was coming out of their smokestacks or what was going into the water or what was into the landfills. I mean, there was no law saying industry had reported. And so it was the first time Congress had ever passed anything and was called the Toxic Release Inventory. So the public, you know, if the chemical plant that was right in your backyard, you would know what they were putting out. And so industry, it wasn't well known. And here we were number one, and there was never the first bit of information. There was never the first article in a newspaper. Almost half of our politicians had contracts with them. Our senator had contracts. And, you know, and matter of fact, the head of the EPA at that time was Phil Graham's campaign manager. So how can you how can you get information?
So what did you do, Diane Wilson? How did you respond to this?
Well, all I did is, like I said, I'm a naturally real quiet person. All I did was simply call a meeting. That was my first action. And there was such this extraordinary backlash, it just totally surprised me. I couldn't figure out what in the Sam Hill was going on. Because, you know, I bet I had never in my life, first of all, ever called a meeting. I had never talked to a bank president. I had never talked to the commissioners. I had never talked to a senator. And suddenly, they were down there at the fish house trying to make me cancel my meeting, not asking questions, you know. And here I am, you know, I'm just going by common sense. It's like, what's the matter with knowing what kind of chemicals are out there? It didn't make sense, you know, and it come to find out it was the, what was happening was the biggest investment, chemical investment that Texas had ever seen, and it was the biggest in the United States in 10 years. So it was a huge chemical expansion. As a matter of fact, it was by one of the biggest polluters in Taiwan, and he was so bad he was kicked out of Taiwan. And, you know,
and so he came to Texas.
He came to Texas.
This is Formosa Plastics.
Formosa Plastics. You got her.
And so you just called. You just said, hey, let's have a public meeting and discuss this. And all of a sudden, all these politicians are coming out of the woodwork going, whoa, don't do that. Please,
yeah,
don't do that. And you went ahead with your meeting.
Yeah, I went ahead with my meeting. And then, you know, everything that we tried, it, well, you know, because I started asking for hearings or we did petitions or, you know, there was, it's the typical stuff that you read that activists, you know, you should do. You should have your meetings. You should, you know, if you're concerned, you do petitions or you call your senator or you, and, you know, it took me a while. I went through all the regular channels and I found out is that they are going to get their permits. They are going to violate the law, and I am not saying that lightly. I mean the EPA, the state agencies, they will violate federal law, and it does not matter. And you know, and
it doesn't matter?
It does.
You mean
not,
they get away with it?
They get away with it, and they'll even acknowledge it. I know when, like I did one of my actions against Formosa, I was fighting their wastewater permit, and legally it was blocked. They could not discharge until an appellate court ruled on it. And, you know, and I just happened to find out because my name was Diane, and at that time Formosa had a real high-powered lawyer named Diana Dutton. I think originally she came out of Washington, and the EPA lawyer thought they were talking to the Formosa lawyer, and so they were just talking about this discharge, and it was totally illegal. And, you know, and that was that brought me to one of my civil disobedience acts. But, you know, it was like it doesn't matter.
In other words, they just continued polluting even after they were told to stop.
Oh yeah.
What was your civil disobedience?
Well, up to that point, I think I had did three hunger strikes, and on that last action, I took my own shrimp boat, which was a 42-foot shrimp boat, and I'd been shrimping on it for 12 years, and it was the only thing I had to my name, and I knew I had to get past this numbness in people's mind about what's going on. It, you know, you have to do, it's almost like what they call over in the poor Iraq war is this shock and awe, and I had to do a shock and awe. So I took my own shrimp boat and attempted to sink it right on top of their discharge point.
You're
it was
kidding.
Going. No, really. I really did.
You sank your own shrimp boat on top of their discharge point. And how did they? What happened as a result?
Well, what I had was I had about three boatloads of Coast Guard, and they, probably about 19 men in all, and they said I was a terrorist on the high seas, and this was long time before 9/11, so
right.
You know, I was one of the original terrorists, and they was going to give me like 19 years in a penitentiary and a $500,000 penalty. And the thing it was the chemical company that was illegal. I mean, the EPA even admitted it. They said, yeah, we know it's illegal, but it's up to our discretion.
This is an absolutely remarkable story. This is Diane Wilson. I so honor the work that you have done, your willingness to put yourself on the line. And I just have to tell our listeners, get this book,
heart.
An Unreasonable Woman is the title of the book by Diane Wilson, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas. Congratulations, Diane. You have done an extraordinary thing here. And but I'm assuming the battle is still ongoing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always ongoing as long as these corporations, they can do what they want.
Yeah.
Know?
And as long as they have breath, as long as we have breath, we'll keep standing up. And as long as they have money, they'll keep.
That's right.
There you go.
Right.
Okay, Diane Wilson, check out the book, An Unreasonable Woman, a true story of shrimpers, politicos, polluters, and the fight for Seadrift, Texas, our pioneer for the day, Diane Wilson. Thanks, Diane.
You're quite welcome.
Keep up the great work. Keep spreading the word. It is so important. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Come together right now
over me. Right. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 24 and a half minutes past the hour. This is interesting. One of the folks in the chat room just shared this with me. Militaryfreezone.org/opt_out. An interesting website worth checking out. Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, how's everything going today?
Well, it's It's getting warmer here, and it's also getting more cloudy as we are expecting some of the after effects of the hurricane. But what I think is really interesting is that the right wing is going totally and completely bananas about Robert Kennedy Jr.'s comments that this could have been, of course, caused by global warming.
Now, when did Robert Kennedy say this, and in what venue?
I believe he said it either last night or this morning, but it's making its rounds today.
And how is the right wing going bananas on this?
Well, they're saying that he should never have said anything, that how does he know?
Who's the they?
These are all the various right-wing talk show hosts and some of the websites and all this, the talking points issued from the Republican National Committee, et cetera.
So it's got nothing to do with carbon dioxide. It's got nothing to do with global warming. There's no droids here you want to see. Just keep moving along. Really...
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Right. That seems to be the bottom line here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one of the things that we're going to be seeing is this is going to heat up the war. Now, it's so interesting that you have Hillary Clinton.
It's going to heat up the war?
It's going to heat up the war on this.
Oh, I see.
But Hillary Clinton and John McCain, who are both clearly running for president, are now declaring after their trip to Alaska the effects of global warming. They are heeding the sort of Al Gore piece of advice that he was given by some of his campaign people that he never paid attention to, which is talk to people about the environment. Clearly, Hillary Clinton and John McCain have heard that recommendation. But it's interesting, the Bushies have not. And the Republicans on the right wing are simply saying, it isn't an issue, not a chance, nothing to worry about.
Wouldn't it be more accurate, Ellen, to say not that the Bushies have not heard that, but that the Bushies cannot hear that because they would have to then turn down millions and millions of dollars in campaign contributions from dirty polluting industries?
That's probably the case. That's a very good analysis. What's also an interesting thing is that the president is coming back to town tomorrow.
And this is because, presumably, of the hurricane and the devastation in New Orleans and that area?
Exactly. I think that he is feeling, obviously, it's not a good time to be at the ranch. He wants to help FEMA coordinate things, and that is what he's going to be doing.
So it's a PR, it's a photo op opportunity. Plus, down at the ranch, he's got a deal with Cindy Sheehan camped out across the street from him.
Right, and Cindy Sheehan is going to take up her bus tour very shortly, and she's going to leave there. So now that we know the president is leaving, she will be leaving. And you're right, it gets Cindy Sheehan off the front pages, gets the war in Iraq off the front pages. He can look presidential, and that is exactly what he's going to be doing in Washington, D.C.
Ellen, do you give any credence to these reports from CapitolHillBlue.com that George Bush has started running around yelling, and he's swearing about, you know, that blankety-blank bitch, Cindy Sheehan, and he's becoming irascible. He's becoming like a tyrant. He screams.
Well, you know, Capitol Hill Blue has always published those kinds of things, not only about Bush, but about other people. They love to do that kind of stuff, and I just never know whether their stuff is accurate or not.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, they've said stuff about the Clintons. I mean, that's the kind of stuff Capitol Hill Blue always publishes. And honestly, I've covered this town. Victoria's covered this town, and we just can't vouch for them one way or the other.
So it's sort of like the National Enquirer of the online world.
That's right.
Yeah, but does it make sense?
Sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're not.
Yeah, but Bush does have a mean streak, and he does have an obscenity streak. Right?
Well, he does have a mean streak. He does have, I don't know that I haven't heard him shout obscenities, but I hear he sometimes does.
Well, yeah, he's been caught on microphone, you know, talking about reporters, and remember that?
Right.
During the first campaign?
Yeah. He did that about a reporter. That's true.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay, we'll find out. Ellen Ratner, thanks so much. The Talk
You're
Radio
welcome.
News Service. Have a great one. Give our best to Victoria, too. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Yeah, Yeah, things generally do tend to work out. If you work at them, if we try to bring democracy back to the United States, if we put some effort into this thing, if we get out there and stand up and speak out, then it is possible that everything will turn out all right. I have high hopes for this country, and one of the things that gives me such high hopes is people like Janet Bates. Janet is on the line live from Crawford, Texas. Hey, Janet.
Oh, hi.
Janet is a musician who performed on this program a few weeks ago, and janetbates.com is her website. But right now she's down in Crawford, Texas with Cindy Sheehan. And, Janet, I understand some interesting things are happening down there.
Well, I just wanted to report on something that happened last night that was very special. And I think it was kind of unexpected, so a lot of the major media wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Last night there was a vigil at Camp KC1, which is the camp where there's the Camp Reality across the street, which is the Bush supporters.
Right.
They scheduled a vigil there, and there was plans to sing songs and then light candles, and each of the people there who had lost a loved one in the Iraq War was to name them and then place candles by the crosses.
Mm-hmm.
And before all this started, the fellow, his name was Jeff Keith, and he's an Iraq veteran, and he was the one that was scheduled to play taps.
Mm-hmm.
He, they're a very tall, impressive man. He said, what I'd like to do is to go to the other side of the road and invite those people there for our vigil, and I first of all want to make sure that nobody here, we're going to lay down any of our politics and any of our controversies, and so he okayed that, and everybody cheered him on, and then the police in the middle escorted him over there. He brought back a group of people, one of whom had a huge flag, American flag on the top, and a flag of his own underneath that said, lest we forget.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back, and we had a vigil and a ceremony together with the Bush supporters.
So the Bush supporters joined you on your side of the road in the ceremony honoring the fallen dead in Iraq.
Yes, and they sang in songs, and then they also had candles for, I believe there was one or two people there who had loved ones, and they lit candles, there was 12, and they lit candles, and I'm not sure there was 12 from the other side, but altogether there was 12. I believe there was one or two people from the other side who lit candles and named people they had lost in the war. And then he played taps, and then in the end, everybody sang the Star Spangled Banner together, and it was an extremely moving moment. And then they walked back to their side of the road, and the ceremony ended. So
and they went back to being Bush supporters.
Yeah, and actually there was a mother there who said that. And she was from the other side, and she said that the one thing that we all, as parents of people who had been lost there, had in common is that we didn't want anyone to forget those that had died there. And that was one area that there was common ground.
Wow. That's extraordinary, Janet Bates. Janet, I'm curious, what's your sense of who the folks are who are out there supporting Bush? Do you think that they are... are they being paid to be out there? Are they simply misinformed about things that are going on? Or, you know, in other words, do they believe, for example, that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11, or that it really is a good idea for us to just pick dictatorships around the world and start knocking them off and replacing them with democracy? I mean, what motivates them to be out there?
Well, I think there was I haven't spent a lot of time talking with them, and I know that there was family members who were very upset at Cindy and actually wanted their names, their children's names taken off the clock, you know, make sure that their children's names weren't there because they felt that that she wasn't representing their cause.
Mm-hmm.
But the only one that I spent any time hearing speak, there was a young fellow there who's taught for quite a while with on the Brad show, and Brad interviewed him, and I think a lot of his messages, and he talked for about an hour and a half. He really just talked in circles, I found. You know, he any real questions he never really answered as to his support for Bush. And he really thought that both sides should sit down and talk about this, but he really never got to the point where somebody was going to need to compromise.
So he was just doing talking points.
Pardon that?
He was just doing talking points. He was just reciting the propaganda lines and not really going anywhere, not going a level deeper with it in terms of the discussion.
No. It seemed very, very shallow. And he called Cindy a fanatic, and he said that that's why Bush wouldn't meet with her. I couldn't help but wish that I could have asked him, you know, whether he thought that Pat Robertson maybe wasn't also a fanatic, you know. But he didn't seem to. And I personally don't think that Cindy's a fanatic, but, you know, I think her questions are very clear, and they should be answerable, but as we all know, there really aren't answers.
Yeah. Well, and it all depends on how you define fanatic. If it's somebody who's absolutely committed to their cause, then Cindy is. I mean, we see it as a pejorative. It doesn't need to be. It may
right.
be,
yeah,
you know, it could
I
be
agree.
A positive,
yeah.
I suppose. Okay, well, that's a fascinating story. Janet Bates, thanks so much for sharing that with us today.
Okay, well, thank you for
I appreciate
having
it.
Me on.
And keep up the great work down there. We look forward to seeing you when you get back to Oregon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks. Janet Bates, janetbates.com, her website, if you want to check out some just great music that Janet has put together. Did Time Magazine intentionally deceive its readers in the Valerie Plame case? This is a fascinating story coming out of Media Matters right now. It turns out that Time Magazine, we all know about Matt Cooper and Judy Miller. Judy Miller is now in jail. Matt Cooper, instead of going to jail, he was the Time Magazine reporter. Judy Miller, of course, for the New York Times. Both of them people that Karl Rove called when he was dialing for dollars. Right after George W. Bush received the memo, as he and Colin Powell were flying to Africa on Air Force One, George W. Bush receives the memo from the State Department talking about who Joe Wilson is and who his wife is. And hours later, Karl Rove is dialing for dollars, and he calls both Matt Cooper and Valerie, and Judith Miller, and outs Valerie Plame. And, you know, we know that this happened. What I think most Americans don't realize is that not only did Matt Cooper himself know that Karl Rove had outed Valerie Plame, because Karl Rove had outed Valerie Plame to him, but that he had told his editor that this was the case. The LA Times just wrote a piece about this, basically outing the, you know, putting together a whole timeline on the whole thing. And Duffy, Michael Duffy, Times Washington bureau chief, was the guy who received the email from Cooper, you know, the double, triple secret, super duper deep secret, whatever, you know, deep dark underground secret, and double super secret background, that was the phrase. And then the next day, after Cooper talks to Rove, he talks to Libby, Scooter Libby. Louis Libby, who is the number two guy in Dick Cheney's office. Karl Rove, the number two guy in George W. Bush's office. So here we have both Libby and Rove outing a CIA agent to the same guy, to Matt Cooper. Matt Cooper telling his editor about it. And now here's where it gets really strange. And something that, in my opinion, Time Magazine really needs to be answering for. And needs to be answering to we the people about. Time Magazine, this, you know, part of this giant colossus, AOL Time Warner, this giant corporation which had on its board of directors Colin Powell, that they then, Time Magazine then, over a period of, what, over a year? I think it was probably well more than a year. Because it was in July of 2003 that this first happened. See, that was July, and then I believe it was August that George Bush came out with his...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
So George W. Bush says that, you know, a couple of years ago, and for those 2 years, more or less, Time Magazine runs a series of stories in which they go along with the administration story that nobody knows who did this. They knew that these were lies. The administration, George Bush comes out and says, we don't know who did this. And they knew that he knew. Karl Rove comes out and says, oh, I had nothing to do with this. Time Magazine knows that he did, but they print his story anyway. And so now the Los Angeles Times is, shall we say, calling them to task on it. For example, this from a Time magazine article. This was October 13th, 2003. 3 months after Time magazine, after the story was leaked to Time magazine by Rove and Libby. Time magazine runs an article that has the following paragraph in it. And I quote from Time magazine, October 13, 2003. When word spread last week that the Department of Justice was launching a full criminal probe into who had leaked Plame's identity, Democrats immediately raised a public alarm. How could justice credibly investigate so secretive an administration, especially when the investigators are led by Attorney General John Ashcroft, whose former paid political consultant Karl Rove was initially accused by Wilson of being the man behind the leak? A Time review of federal and state election records reveals that Ashcroft paid Rove's Texas firm $746,000 for direct mail services in two gubernatorial campaigns and one Senate race from 1984 to 1994. White House spokesman Scott McClellan said accusations of Rove peddling information are, quote, ridiculous, end quote. Says McClellan, quote, there is simply no truth to that suggestion, end of quote. So Time magazine publishing lies from the Bush administration, knowing that they're lies, and not challenging them. Is this appropriate behavior for a news organization? You know, one of the reasons why Jefferson fought so hard to have the Bill of Rights written into the Constitution, particularly the First Amendment defending freedom of the press, was because he believed, as did most of the people of his age, of his generation, believed that without a free press, you could not have a functioning democracy, and that a free press meant a press free both of governmental interference and of oligarchic or plutocratic interference. For this reason, they tried to make the press very, very, make it very easy to go into the newspaper business. One of the very first laws that was passed in the United States was to subsidize newspapers. We subsidized the production of newsprint so that newspapers could print on newsprint very, very cheaply. And we subsidized the postage that is used to mail newspapers. We are still doing that here now. 230 years later, we're still subsidizing the postage used to mail newspapers. Why? Because as Jefferson said, if I had to choose between living in a nation with a government but no newspapers, or a nation with newspapers but no government, I would surely choose the latter. But to have a free press, you have to have a truly free press. And it appears, in my mind, that control by a huge multinational corporation of the press is just as odious as control by government. In either case, you've got a press under control, which is not a healthy thing. So as Media Matters notes, Duffy wrote that Rove was initially accused by Wilson, Time magazine's Duffy, of being the man behind the leak, as though Wilson was no longer making that accusation or that the accusation was found to be without merit. In fact, Wilson did not back down from the charge, although he did allow that he had no proof of Rove's involvement. On CNN, Paul is on now. Joe Wilson, this was on September 29, 2003, said, I don't have any specific information. I would hope that an investigation would yield the information as to who's responsible for this precise leak. What I do have are any number of journalist sources, none of whom I have reason not to believe, who have said that the White House was pushing the story after the leak, after the Novak article, and including Karl Rove. And thus, Joe Wilson, you know, making statements like...
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And then Joe Wilson, the former ambassador, a diplomat, saying, you know, I don't use names lightly.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Yeah, so, you know, Joe Wilson never backed away. Why is Time magazine saying that he initially accused Karl Rove of being behind? You know, it just doesn't make sense. One 888-889-8894, telephone number. Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, I want your opinion of something.
Yes, sir.
There's some really neat ideas, I think, here for campaign bumper stickers. And let me run a few past you. The first one, how about Exxon Bush 04?
Or 08.
Yeah, how about Rove and Satan 08?
Well, that's already happened.
Right. How about Lockheed Martin Bush 04?
Yeah.
What about
Ken Lay and Bush 02, you know, 00? I mean, it's, yeah.
How about Jesus and War Prophets, and it's spelled PROPHEPS?
Yeah, see, that's illustrating the tragedy of the co-opting of Christianity by these guys, Armin, and I know you realize that.
I got another one too. This one I think is real fitting.
Okay.
Considering last week, how about the 700 Devils Club?
The 700 Killers Club. How's that? The 700 Assassins Club. Armin, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. It's the 700 Assassins Club. Well, you know, yeah, it's a possibility. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Evolutionary Talk Radio, intelligently designed.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 55 minutes past the hour, or 4.5 minutes before the hour. Hey, if you have any doubts at all that the Bush administration is being run like an organized crime family, that war profiteering is going on, just talk to Congressman Henry Waxman. Waxman just wrote a letter to Don Rumsfeld demanding to know why Bunatine Greenhouse, yes, that's a woman's name, a career civil servant in the senior executive service, was fired or demoted. Turns out she testified before Congress on June 27th. About Halliburton's Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary. This is the subsidiary that they reincorporated in the Cayman Islands so that they wouldn't have to pay U.S. taxes on the war profits that they're making. The one that, you know, when John Kerry voted against the appropriation was because he didn't want U.S. tax dollars going to a corporation that didn't pay U.S. taxes on its profits. Anyhow, she testified that there was undue influence, that there was influence peddling going on here. She testified, according to Henry Waxman's letter, specifically, Ms. Greenhouse objected to the contract awarded to a Halliburton subsidiary. She testified the contract award process was compromised by improper influence by political appointees, participation by Halliburton officials in meetings where bidding requirements were discussed, and a lack of competition. We're talking huge bucks here. We're talking millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe even billions of dollars. And she was told by, he says now, the Secretary of the Army before her testimony on July 4th, 3 weeks before her testimony, after her testimony, the Secretary of the Army approves of her removal, and that she had been warned before that it wouldn't be a good idea for her career-wise to testify before Congress. What's going on with Ms. Greenhouse? Well, it is the Bush administration acting like the mafia. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. It's like, you know, this is like the bad mob stuff from the 60s down in Louisiana and Florida when Marcello and Trafficante ran that part of the country. It's just, it's you know, they're going to do it their way. They're going to do it. It's corrupt. People are going to make millions. People are going to make billions. And, hey, it's the taxpayers' dollars. Who cares? That's the Bush administration's mindset on this thing. Henry Waxman, he's saying, hey, I'd like to know what's going on. His letter co-signed by Byron Dorgan and Frank Lautenberg. We'll see if there's any response. Somehow I doubt that Rummy is going to respond. Now he's got to make sure that his friends are well paid. But you might want to let Henry Waxman know that, you know, good on you. Keep it up. Keep up the good work. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change. Welcome back to our program. The Associated Press today and the New York Times reporting a change in poverty in the United States. Nation's poverty rate rose to 12.7% of the population last year, the fourth consecutive annual increase, according to the Census Bureau. Overall, there were 1.1 million more people living in poverty in 2004 than had been living in poverty in 2003. And there were more people living in poverty in 2003 than there had been in 2002. And there were more people living in poverty in the United States in 2002 than there had been in the year 2000. In fact, the year 2000 was the last year before George W. Bush came to office that the poverty rate had been declining in the United States. You see, for all his faults, and they were many, Bill Clinton's, even his economic faults, particularly his trade policy faults, his DLC faults. Nonetheless, Bill Clinton believed in having balanced budgets, in having taxes that actually, you know, taxed wealthy people to pay for the commons, to pay for their use of the commons. And having policies in the United States, a social safety net that would provide for some basis of living. He didn't think it was a good idea that there be huge disparities between super rich and super poor. The conservatives, on the other hand, think it's just fine for there to be super rich and super poor. After all, it's they're kind of Calvinist in their perspective. The poor are poor because they're moral failures. The rich are rich because God blessed them. It was John Calvin's idea. It animated the early Calvinist church, and it still does in some places to some regard. This is why Pat Robertson has gone off the deep end about Hugo Chavez. Now, you would think that a Christian minister in the United States would be talking about, you know, Matthew 25, the one place, or probably the most visible place, you know, the Great Commission, the one place in the Bible where Jesus' followers said, yeah, how do we get into heaven? And he said, well, you know, in the last days, I'm going to be sitting here on my throne separating the sheep from the goats. The sheep are going to go to heaven and the goats are going to go to hell. And who's going to be the sheep? Well, they're going to be the people who fed me when I was hungry and gave me water when I was thirsty and gave me clothes when I was naked and visited me when I was in prison and took care of me when I was sick. And the disciples are looking at each other just shocked, slack-jawed, shocked amazement. We are in deep trouble. Because Jesus had never been hungry. He'd never been thirsty. He'd never been naked. He'd never been in prison. And so he'd never been sick. And so they said to him, hey, you know, if that's what we've got to do to get into heaven is take care of you when you're sick, you haven't been sick yet. What about us? How do we get into heaven? And Jesus said, as you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do unto me, right? In other words, take care of the poor. And then they said, well, what about these people who are going to hell, the goats? What about that? He says, they're the ones who didn't give me water when I was thirsty, give me food when I was hungry. You know, I don't need to turn this into a ministry. You know the story. And again, he says, as you didn't do the least among these, you didn't do to me. So you would think that Pat Robertson, who, you know, should know this stuff, right? I mean, this is probably, you know, along with the Sermon on the Mount, in the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th chapters of Matthew. This is one of the two central teachings of Christianity. You'd think that Pat Robertson would get it. Why is it then that Hugo Chavez, who presumably is Catholic, Hugo Chavez gets it and has turned it into a political position, and Pat Robertson doesn't. As Benjamin Dongle notes in an alternate article, under Chavez's government, literacy campaigns began. Oh, you can't read? We'll help you learn how to read. Now, see, the cons, again, they'd say, reading? We don't need people to read. We just need them to work in the factories. No, Dangle says, under Chavez's government, literacy campaigns began. Land reform was undertaken. Land reform? Land reform, isn't that a euphemism from taking some land from the rich and giving it to the poor? Isn't that Marxism? Land reform? Well, what if the rich got the land by illegal or inappropriate means? Doesn't matter. It's ours now. See, oligarchs have a way of gaming the system. Free dentists' offices were opened. Free dental services? Wait a minute, there's no such thing as free. That must mean that it's being paid for with tax dollars. Oh my God, it's Marxism. Well, no, it's not. See, Marxism is where the government owns the means of production and distribution. It owns all the factories. It owns the way that things are distributed. It owns everything. That's not what Chavez is talking about. He opened free hospitals. Free hospitals? Well, yeah, every other industrialized country in the world except the United States has free hospitals. Totally free. The Japanese, you know that liberal Harry Truman, he helped them write a constitution? Free hospitals. The Germans, that liberal Harry Truman, helped them write a constitution? Free hospitals. The Brits, after World War II, looked around and said, hey, you know, we should get in on that. Let's have free hospitals. The French, as they were being rebuilt after World War II, yeah, free hospitals, that's a plan. Free doctors, too. Healthcare is a right, not a privilege. Every country in the world except the United States, and now every first world, every fully developed country except the United States, and now third world countries are starting to get into the act. Venezuela, free hospitals. How dare he, says Pat Robertson. He should be assassinated. Free schools constructed in the poorest neighborhoods. No, we shouldn't do that. What we should do is give them vouchers. And the vouchers should not be for enough money to actually pay for an education. Why would you do that? Why is it that the Bushies are pushing for $2,000 and $3,000 vouchers instead of public education? When in most school districts around the country, it costs about $5,600 a year to educate a child. That's the average in the United States, between $5,000 and $6,000 a year. Why is it that the Bushies are pushing for $2,000 to $3,000 vouchers instead of $5,000 to $6,000 vouchers? Well, the answer is very simple. If you have a voucher for $2,000 or $3,000, that means that if you're going to put your child to private school, you're going to have to pay $2,000 or $3,000 as well. Which means that the well-off, the middle class, the upper middle class, who can afford to come up with the extra $2,000 or $3,000 a year, their children will have one set of schools. And the working poor and the truly poor, who can't afford that $2,000 to $3,000 to go along with the voucher, they will be left with the public schools. It's called separate but equal. So Chavez says, no, we're not going to have that. We're going to have high-quality schools in the poorest neighborhoods, absolutely free. The conservatives are getting hysterical now. And how about food? Government-subsidized supermarkets and business cooperatives. Business cooperatives. We're going to help entrepreneurs? We're going to help small people get into business for themselves? Oh, we can't have this. We just can't have this. We've got to assassinate this guy, says Pat Robertson. Agrirres Milapanis writes an article in The Militant. He points out, the Chavez administration had angered most of Venezuela's wealthy ruling families and their allies in Washington by doubling the royalties that investors have to pay for oil exploration contracts. Say what? We'd like to invest, we'd like to explore for oil, twice the royalty, and taking other measures to strengthen state control of the country's natural resources. Other measures passed by the government in the fall of 2001, this when Chavez first came into office, that really, really upset the wealthy, the oligarchs, those who control Venezuela, like they control these small number of families. I mean, it's like a feudal system. In Europe, you know, the wealthy families, they would intermarry with each other to solidify relationships. Sometimes they'd have wars with each other that were not quite wars, really, because they really weren't trying to knock each other off. They were just trying to keep the serfs occupied. You know, the old Roman notion of bread and circus, and the war was the circus. You just keep them fed, keep them entertained. You don't have to worry about them. It's called a Walmart job and cable TV. It's the modern version of bread and circus. Anyhow, an agrarian reform law. A bill protecting small fishermen from overfishing by large commercial companies. What? We're going to protect the small farmers, the small fishers? And the allocation of state funds for affordable housing and other social programs. You're kidding. We're going to use state funds for affordable housing and social programs? And then the straw that broke the camel's back. In May of 2001, Chavez raised the minimum wage from $100 a month to $150 a month. He increased the minimum wage 50%. That would be the same thing as George W. Bush raising our minimum wage from $5.15 an hour to around $7.60 an hour. Holy cow! The country's gross domestic product, by the way, after that increase in the minimum wage, grew 30% in the first quarter of the year. Now, why would that be? Could it be because when working people make more money, they spend more money. They spend more money, they create more demand for goods. They create more demand for goods, more entrepreneurs get into the business of making those goods. They're making more goods. They have to hire more people. They're hiring more people. You got more people making money. Economies are never stagnant. They are always either spiraling up or spiraling down. There is nothing in between. That's why Greenspan is so hysterical about avoiding negative growth in the economy, about avoiding deflation. Drive interest rates into the negative region. We had actual negative interest rates. The interest rate was below the rate of inflation. If you borrowed money and sat on it, when you paid it back, you came out ahead. Because inflation had eroded the value of it more than the interest cost you. He did that for about a year and a half during the Bush administration, in part to help George Bush financially or politically, and in part to avoid going backwards. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
From overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism, but we still got terrorists here living in the USA. The big city.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County, California, has some thoughts on Hugo Chavez. Hey, Alice.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I do appreciate your pointing out why our greedy billionaire states hate someone like Hugo Chavez. I think we do need to understand this.
I agree. And thank you for calling and pointing that out, Alice.
Okay.
Great to hear from you. Always great to hear from you.
Okay.
91 years old and still kicking. I salute you, Alice. Keep up the great work. So here we have the Chavez administration raising the minimum wage, which increases the gross domestic product 30%. And then he starts doing horrible things like public works projects, repairing roads, building bridges. It added new jobs. He improved health care. The people are really upset about this. Well, the rich The extremely rich, the oligarchs, are very upset about it. How dare those riffraff covet political power? How dare they? Barrio Adentro, which translates roughly into heart of the neighborhood, the name of a government-sponsored program that has brought Cuban doctors. See, in Cuba, there's no cap. Anybody can go to medical school if they want, and there's no limit on the number of doctors. Unlike the United States, for example, where the AMA limits the number of people who can go to medical school. To keep a tight supply of doctors, if you limit the supply, you increase the value, right? So you increase the amount of money that doctors can charge. Cuba has so many doctors, they're like giving them away to other countries. Or loaning them out. I'd say probably in this case it's a bit of a trade. Cuba's getting some of Venezuela's oil. Venezuela is getting Cuban doctors. Plus, they're sending Venezuelan students to Cuba to learn how to become doctors so that they can then come back and work in their country of Venezuela and build medical schools in Venezuela. So here's this program, Barrio Adentro, that is building free neighborhood clinics. You know the doc-in-the-box places that were all the rage in the 90s? They're building these things in working-class neighborhoods and rural areas throughout Venezuela, particularly targeting people who live in the slums and people who live in rural agricultural areas where traditionally there has been no medical services because it simply wasn't profitable. This is like, you know, in the United States in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt looked around and said, you know, we've got this electricity, this wonderful new thing. You know, Tom Edison in the 1910s, you know, and George Westinghouse had this big competition, and they electrified, parts of New Jersey and then New York City and then the East Coast. But the rural America doesn't have any electricity because the corporations are running the show, and they can't make money running power lines out to rural houses. And so you have half of America with electricity, the urban half, and half of America, the rural half, no electricity. We've got to do something about this. And so he created the Rural Electrification Administration, the REA, said, okay, we're going to use taxpayer money to run these power lines out to these rural houses, and you, the power companies, have to supply them with electricity. It's a sort of a compromise. We'll pick up the cost of getting the wires out there. You supply them with electricity, and you can make a profit at it, by the way. And then in the 1940s, when telephones became, you know, very widespread, Harry Truman did the same thing. A program that continued right up through the days of LBJ. And so here we have Hugo Chavez now doing the same thing. Oh, another one of those liberals. How dare he think of the people? The people! Speaking of the people, I got to tell you what the right wing is ranting about today with regard to this hurricane. And how Walmart and the corporations of America are sitting around deciding how they're going to help us. I mean, it's hysterical. And it really points up the whole idea of corporate rule, of fascism, and how strongly it has taken hold of America. I got to tell you about this little bit right after this break. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
What was it you wanted? Tell me again so I know. What's happening in there? What's going on in your show?
Well, it's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. The Tom Hartman Radio Program. Welcome back, my friends. It is 33 and a half minutes past the hour. 26 and a half or 27, more or less, minutes before the hour. In 1976, now step into the Wayback Machine here. 1976, George Herbert Walker Bush was head of the CIA. Gerry Ford was president, as I recall. That would have been 76, yeah. And Operation Condor. The CIA was hearing about this thing. Assistant Secretary of State Slaughterman writes a 14-page report, gives it to Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State, and talks about how Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, the South American dictator, excuse me, our ally, was preparing not only to assassinate people in his own country, but was, well, this from a CIA report, quote, preparing to engage in executive action outside the territories of member countries, end quote. In other words, assassinate people outside the boundaries of the country. Pinochet up to this. Thanks, tip of the hat to the folks in the chat room, by the way. Now, we're not complaining about that. I mean, here's Augusto Pinochet. Now, he's been indicted. He's been arrested for murder. Remember? I don't hear Pat Robertson complaining about him. No, he just, you know, killed lefties. He just killed people who believed in social justice. He just killed people who thought, you know, maybe the people should have some say in how the government's run rather than just the oligarchic families. Now, you don't hear Pat Robertson taking Mr. Pinochet to task. You didn't hear Pat Robertson talking much about his old business partner, James Taylor, in Liberia. His partner in the diamond mine business when James Taylor was murdering people in his own country. No, the guy that Pat Robertson's going after, he's the guy who's building free clinics. He's the guy who's taking unused farmland that's been just being held as investment properties by wealthy families and turning it into productive farms and giving it to the poor. How dare he? How dare he? Now, all of that said, I got to say, I just have to tell you this story. I'm broadcasting this show out of a studio, out of a radio station, where I do a morning show here, KPOJ. Clear Channel owns the station. They run five radio stations out of this building. One of them is the station that carries the Rush Limbaugh program. And so during the break, the break 30 minutes ago, I went to the men's room, as I occasionally do during breaks, and there on the speaker in the bathroom is Rush Limbaugh. And he's not taking a break the same time I am. And so he's going on and on. I rarely ever have an opportunity to hear him because he's on the air at the same time I am. And he's talking about, you know, how dare the lefties accuse George W. Bush and the corporations of having anything to do with global warming that might have caused this hurricane. And that, in fact, in boardrooms all across America right now, corporations are sitting around discussing how much aid to give to the hurricane victims. And isn't it wonderful that a Walmart in Louisiana has already opened, like it's a public service, to make money? I mean, it's really pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. And I'm almost speechless. It's like, you know, where do you go from that? I mean, it's how can you know top that, Mister? The reality. The very simple reality is that global warming is real, that it is growing, and that in all probability there is a link between global warming and this giant hurricane. I mean, it's just you know, very straightforward. And if Robert Kennedy Jr. or whoever it is, you know, comes out and says so, well, you know, so they said it. But I just find it incredible that the right is out there just getting absolutely hysterical. How can he say this? What? I can't believe it. You know, that there's a connection between global warming and it's just not possible. How can... Well, as the Center for American Progress points out, severe weather occurrences like hurricanes and heat waves already take hundreds of lives and cause millions of dollars in damage every year. However, data suggests increasingly that human-induced global warming is making them worse. They're making them more dangerous and more extreme. As Ross Gelbspan, who wrote an incredible book, you got to read this book, it's called The Heat Is On, his website, heatisonline.com. Ross Gelbspan says, and I quote, "The hurricane that struck Louisiana yesterday was nicknamed Katrina by the National Weather Service. Its real name is global warming." You can just, you know, this collective gasp, all the cons, you know, Limbo out there going, "No, no, the corporations are preparing to help America." See, this is the big lie that they want you to buy. That if we simply turn administration of the commons over to the wealthy few, over to multimillionaires like Limbaugh and his ilk, that they'll take care of us. They have our best interests at heart. They'll set aside profit when the chips are really down. Even though their way of managing an economy and way of managing businesses has left 40 million of us without insurance, has produced a significant increase, over 1 million additional people going into poverty every year for the last 4 years, reversing a trend of decreasing poverty under the Clinton administration. No, no, don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. Just turn it over to the corporations. And, of course, the corporations had nothing to do with global warming. Nothing at all. The Associated Press reported recently on an MIT study, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that says, now this is MIT, and I quote, "Major storms spinning in both the Atlantic and Pacific have increased in duration and intensity by about 50% since the 1970s, trends that are closely linked to increases in the average temperatures of the ocean surface and also correspond to increases in global average atmospheric temperatures during that same period." To translate that from science ease into English, global warming, we're heating up the atmosphere. That heat is a form of energy. That energy is going to increase the power and severity and intensity of storms. And those storms are named things like Katrina. Now, what's the response of the Bush administration? Given that about half of the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of the United States are coming from our automobiles, well, they say, let's develop new CAFE standards that actually encourage automakers to make bigger, less fuel-efficient cars. And let's pass a law, and yes, it's buried on page 150 of the new CAFE standards that the Bush administration proposed last week. Last week, buried on page 150. Let's pass a law that says that it is against the law for a state to have more stringent regulations about global warming than the federal government. You know, this all ties together. The whole thing of what Chavez is doing, the reason why they want to assassinate him, and, you know, let's be clear about this. Pat Robertson is not the first right-winger to call for the assassination of Chavez. It is, in fact, a very popular idea on the Reich. You know, I mean, how dare he talk about taking care of the people? Don't you know you're supposed to put corporate profits above everything else and then society would be wonderful? Just look at Iraq. We went in there and we said, okay, any corporation can do anything it wants here. And people cannot form unions because that might harm labor profits. That might harm corporate profits. And you can't have strong environmental regulations because that might harm corporate profits. And you can't have rules that say that, foreign corporations have to have a certain amount of domestic content or a certain amount of domestic labor in a product or service because that might harm corporate profits. And you can't have tariffs that protect domestic industries because that might harm corporate profits. No, we're going to turn Iraq into a conservative paradise. Look how well it's worked. They did it in the United States in the 19-teens, the 1920s, right up to 1929. Look how well it worked. It's the way the Victorian England's economy was run. Good old conservative economics in the 1900s, in the 18th century. Charles Dickens did a marvelous job of chronicling for us. Remember Ebenezer Scrooge? And Bob Cratchit? Mr. Scrooge, may I please have a lump of coal for the stub?
No, you may not. That lump of coal will cost an extra penny. I'll have to take it out of your salary.
But please, sir, my hands are too cold. I can't write numbers on the ledger.
No, you can't have a lump of coal. And neither can your son. I don't care if he's got medical problems.
It's the conservative paradise. You know, Dickens's father had been put into debtor's prison. Go back and read A Christmas Carol with that little bit of knowledge, and all of a sudden the whole story starts to make sense. See, it's just the whole thing, once you get it, the whole thing comes into view. That if you believe, as the cons do, if you believe that government of, by, and for the people is a bad idea, that democracy is a bad idea, that government should be purely there to service the interests of wealth, whether it's the wealthy families, like, you know, trying to do away with the Paris Hilton tax, as the Senate will be voting on next week, or whether it's wealthy corporations, multinational corporations, or domestic corporations, if you think that the whole purpose of government should be to serve the interests of wealth and the government should play no role whatsoever in serving the interests of the people, then, you know, you're a classic conservative. And I got to say, you know, we've tried that. And it didn't work very well. Now, we also tried the other extreme of having government do everything, having the government own the factories, having the government own the taxi companies, having the government own the airlines, having the government own the hotels, having the government own everything. And that didn't work either. I've worked in the Soviet Union. I've been in East Germany when it was East Germany. It didn't work. Absolute, total, mad dog, raw, unrestrained, laissez-faire capitalism doesn't work. It will destroy itself. At the end of the Monopoly game, you have one winner standing. Everybody else loses. And at that point, the game is over. On the other hand, eliminating capitalism altogether, eliminating free enterprise altogether, and saying the government is going to run it, that doesn't work either. But there's that middle place where we have been in this country since its founding, and we've wandered to the left and right of it, mostly to the right of it, many times. And every time the farther to the right of it that we get, the worse our economy gets. And then you look at countries that have really high quality standards of living. Countries like Sweden and Denmark and Norway, who have embraced government regulation of capitalism and free enterprise so that it serves the people as well as the wealthy. It works very well. Mike in Washington, D.C. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
A couple of quick thoughts. First of all, the hurricane was definitely aided by global warming, and that's why it exploded, was because the Gulf was at 90 degrees.
Right, yeah.
Secondly, here's an interesting thought. Most of the people that ended up in the Superdome were there because they were too poor. They either didn't have a car or they didn't have means of getting a bus ticket out of town.
That's right.
And if they had been planning for this for years, as they say they have, they should have had mandatory evacuation set up with
military vehicles. actually, Mike, pardon my interrupting you, but I got to say, there was a proposal put forward 2 years ago to plan for this, and the Bush administration cut the funding for it.
Oh, right. But I'm saying that is what, you know, if you're going to, if you're faced with a situation that you have, they had to plan on mandatory evacuation if they really cared, but they didn't want to spend the money.
Yeah.
This is a case where the right-wing karma got run over by their dog.
There you go. Well said. Well said, Mike. Thank you. Yeah, in fact, 2 months ago, President Bush took an axe to budget funds that would have helped New Orleans prepare for such a disaster. The New Orleans branch of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers suffered a record $71.2 million reduction in federal funding, a 44.2% reduction from its 2001 levels. Yes, indeed. You can thank George Bush for the mess in Louisiana.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Here they come again. Catch us if you can.
And welcome back, my friends. 55 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Cecilia in Florida on the line. Hey, Cecilia, you've solved the mystery.
I solved it.
Okay.
Who did
that great bumper music, the Razzle Dazzle?
I have searched for months, and I even contacted Billionaires for Bush, and they said no, yes, they were not. It is
not
a gentleman named Bill Jacobs, and I've got the link ready to go when I get off with you. I'm going to send you the link. You can actually download it, along with another song, If I Only Had a Brain.
Okay, great. Actually, somebody has already, I've already gotten that in email. I just keep forgetting to mention it, so I'm so glad that you called about it. What is the website, very quickly?
www.BillJacobs.us/YRDEHTML.
Okay, although probably BillJacobs.us will just get them to his homepage, right?
Right, and I just wanted everybody to know, because we need to have like some kind of like collection of all these great music that you guys put on.
Yeah, we find them in the strangest places, and not always do we know where it came from. You know, it's so anyhow. Thanks so much, Cecilia.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Great to hear from you too. In Ross Gelbspan today in the Boston Globe, the hurricane that struck Louisiana yesterday was nicknamed Katrina by the National Weather Service. Its real name is global warming. When the year began with a 2-foot snowfall in Los Angeles, the cause was global warming. When 124-mile-an-hour winds shut down nuclear plants in Scandinavia and cut power to hundreds of thousands of people in Ireland and the United Kingdom, the driver was global warming. When a severe drought in the Midwest dropped water levels in the Missouri River to their lowest levels on record this summer, the reason was global warming. In July, when the worst drought on record triggered wildfires in Spain and Portugal and left water levels in France at their lowest levels in 30 years, the explanation was global warming. When a lethal heat wave in Arizona kept temperatures above 110 degrees and killed 20 people in a week, the culprit was global warming. And when the Indian city of Bombay received 37 inches of rain in one day, killing 1,000 people and disrupting the lives of 20 million, the villain was global warming. How dare he say that? He's got Limbaugh absolutely hysterical. If Limbaugh has a heart attack today, it'll be, or a stroke, it'll be because Ross Gelbspan, a guy who just, you know, happened to win a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting, pointed this out. For years, the fossil fuel industry, he says, has lobbied the media to accord the same weight to a handful of global warming skeptics as it accords the finding of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, more than 2,000 scientists from 100 countries reporting to the United Nations. Yeah. It shouldn't be called Hurricane Katrina. It should be called Hurricane Global Warming. And you want to know the source? Talk to George W. Bush's biggest donors. Thanks a lot for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Take good care of yourself. And pass the good word along, you know. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.